So good morning, everyone. Welcome again to the session. I think it's our fourth or fifth session at Pathways End, main 7-day session. As is customary, the first Taisho for the week will be on Mu, the Koan Mu. But again, before we proceed with that, I just again was struck by the verse that we've just recited. And I mentioned it before, but it's always worth remembering that the Dharma is rarely encountered even in hundreds of thousands of millions of ages. What that means is that very few people are aware of the Dharma. It doesn't mean, of course, that it's never encountered. It's always encountered. In some Zendos, they recite, it's always encountered. But really what it means is we very, very rarely see it, or very, very few people. You know, I'm talking about people or beings, maybe I should say beings. Very few beings actually see it or are aware of it, you know. And of course, that comes back to our purpose of being here, is to be able to see it. It's always there. So it's rarely encountered even in hundreds of thousands of millions of ages. Now we can see it. As in now we can see it. It's got nothing to do with what is being said. It's all about now, being able to see now, what is now. You know, now we can see it, hear it, and so forth. So it's very important to keep that in mind, that it's always about right now. And this koan is about right now, nothing else. It's just another name, Mu. That's what this koan is about. So I'll just read out the koan. The case. The monk asked Joshua in all earnestness, does a dog have Buddha nature or not? And Joshua said, Mu. So, Mu means no in Chinese, or nothing, or Wu, sorry, in Japanese, and Wu in Chinese. The collection comes from the Mumon Kan collection, the gateless gate or the gateless barrier. And Mumon, of course, was the compiler, as you most of you would know, of that particular koan collection. There are about five collections in our lineage that students will go through. And each koan is presented as a barrier. There's only one barrier, even though there are 700 koans. So we might think of every koan as a separate barrier, but it's only ever one barrier. And that is the barrier of Mu. Once we have managed to clearly see through that one barrier, there are no other barriers. And as students that have started off seeing that barrier of Mu, or penetrating Mu, once they have penetrated this no barrier, whatever you want to call it, and still get stuck on others, that just means that the clarification is not sharp yet. So we keep on clarifying the same koan, Mu, 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 even though it's got a million names. Like now. What does now mean? It's the same, it's just another name for it as well. So Mumon Kan collected these koans or stories or encounter dialogues, whatever, or predicaments, there are many words for them. He started off with this one koan Mu as number one, and our tradition has taken on that as a first koan that students work on. As their breakthrough koan, if you like. In other traditions, as most of you know, other koans are used. But I would say most tradition, certainly from the Zanbo Zen lineage, would use, or those that derive from that lineage would use the koan mu. And the reason that Mumon put that first is because that was his breakthrough koan. He had that koan and he worked on it for 6 years before he had a breakthrough. And after those 6 years, Mumon, who was, by the way, a master in the Rinzai lineage, he lived in the Sung dynasty, 1183 to 1260. And he then wrote a verse, and this was his verse. He wrote, "A thunderclap under the clear blue sky. A thunderclap under the clear blue sky. All beings on earth open their eyes. All beings on earth open their eyes. Everything under heaven bows together. Mount Sumeru leaps up and dances." So that was his verse that he wrote after he had his Kensho experience. Kensho means seeing your true self. That's what Kensho means. An experience where you see your true self. That's what it means. And so at age 46, he started compiling this Mumon Khan collection. And of course, in our lineage, that is the second book that we work on. So here we are, working on Mu. A lot of people here are working on Mu. And it's first of all, famous Mu, one thing should be said about it: it cannot be explained. No matter who you talk to, you cannot explain what Mu is. We all need to discover that over and over and over again. You know, ourselves. We need to. When I say discover it over and over again, is even though we might have had a reference point of it, but that reference point was in the past. We need to see it right now. You know, right now, always right now. And so that's the challenge, even for those that have already penetrated, to always see Mu right now. And of course, that is actually the core practice of Zen. The core practice of Zen, and of course, the core practice also of Buddhism. And when I say that is the core practice, we have different practices to get to that point of seeing it. So Buddhism has developed different practices to get to that point of seeing it. And those practices, and again, I'm repeating myself, most of you would know because I talk about it all the time, are based on the Four Noble Truths and the Eightfold Path. And the training principles are, number one, concentration. That is what we're doing here. We are practicing concentration. Number two, precept practice. We read the precepts out this morning, and the way we practice them is to follow them as closely and as best as we can. And in our tradition, for those that are new, most students are encouraged to read the precepts out before they sit every day, and that has the effect that the precepts start working on us. In other words, we become very intimate with them and we become very sensitive to us or recognizing when we have broken them. And that sensitivity is a very, very important part of the practice, because that sensitivity challenges us to do better the next time. And that in itself is a mind purification practice. We are purifying ourselves through our conduct, through our precept practice, in order to be able to sit and concentrate, actually. Because that we cannot concentrate if we are not at ease. If we are not at ease, and that may be because ethically we are being compromised, because we are not, our mind, our speech, our thought, and our action does not align. They're going in different directions, and that is disturbing, and that shows itself in our discursive thinking on the cushion. So when we are totally at peace, in other words, when we are totally at peace and at one with the precepts or with our precept practice, that feeds into our general practice of sitting. The next one, of course, is wisdom practice. Wisdom practice is really, again, a core teaching of the Buddha, and especially in Zen. And wisdom practice only really starts, I mean, there are many levels of wisdom practice, but in our tradition, koan work is wisdom practice. Repeat. So through koans, we are challenged to see the Dharma, capital D. And seeing that Dharma and challenging us to see that from all the weeds that are there, that is what we refer to as wisdom practice. So the wisdom, if you like, in this sense, can almost be equated with the Dharma, capital D. We are seeing it clearly. Yeah. So we have these three practices in Zen. For one purpose, and that purpose is to see our true nature. And even there, what does that mean? To see our true nature. Okay. The nicest definition of that, the simplest one that I like, is to see who we are beyond the story that I have about myself. To see who anything is, or what anything is, beyond the story that I assign to it. I remember talking at length at another koan, at another session, about not leaving any remainder. So if I look at anything, I look at it usually through the interpretation of my story. If I see a cushion, immediately I look at it, is that now in a straight line? Is it not in a straight line? Oh, why is it black? Why isn't it white? I immediately look at it through my own story, my own conditioning, whatever you want to call it. So no matter how I look at the world, it's a reflection of me. And if that me is self-referencing and a small I, that is how I see the entire world. That is how I see you. That is how I see the birds. That is how I see it. It's a mirror. Whatever I see is a mirror. If I see bad, I am bad. It's in me. If I see good, I am good. It's that mirror that is always reflected. And here we are. Our practice here doing the session is to let go of that. To let go of the story. No story. It's not easy. Because we, not only aren't we used to continuously engaging in a story, it's almost a default setting that we have. And again, I'm repeating myself, the way we do that is to substitute whatever comes with mu. Mu is an object of concentration. So we just repeat mu. Or for some people that are not working on mu, it might be the breath, or it might be another mantra. No matter what happens while we sit, our thoughts creep in, and we just exchange it with mu. So there's two things that are in your mind. It's your story about something, or it's mu. And be careful that mu doesn't become a story either. You know. So is it a story? If it's a story and you recognize that you're in your story, change it over to mu. Mu. You know. Mu. Mu. Keep on mooing. And then again, back. That's the practice that we do while we are here. So here we go. A monk asked, does a dog have Buddha nature or not? So that's the question that the monk asked. Does a dog have Buddha nature or not? He is in a story, this monk. Does a dog have Buddha nature? He's already, so does it or doesn't it have a Buddha nature? So he's already in a story, the monk. And Joshu transcends that story somehow by not giving him an intellectual answer, because that's another story. He simply says, moo. That's it. Moo. So that's his answer. And as I said, I think I said it in the previous session, it's the story of all questions. The questions of all questions is any question. Doesn't matter what the question is, that is it. It's we're trying to penetrate what underlies every question. And the answer mu is the answer of all answers. We're trying to penetrate the answer that underlies all answers. There is no more, but could it be this, or could it be that, or why is it not this, or should I go and ask about this, or is it, there's no more of that. When we get mu, it's all the answers. You know, that's very, very powerful. So this is what this practice is about, seeing all the answers, getting all the answers. I'm still reading it, I'm enjoying it very much, Taoism at the moment. And Chuang Tzu is a famous Taoist philosopher. He lived about the same time as the Buddha. So that's how far back it goes. And he is incredibly clear on this world of the Dharma, even though he doesn't call it Dharma. In those days, there was no Buddhism in China. And he names it different things. And one of the things that he refers to, which I just love it, the way he expresses it is, he said, we get entangled with what is borrowed. We get entangled with what is borrowed. Everything is borrowed. It's another word for impermanence. Like the Buddha is borrowed. That Buddha there is borrowed. We are borrowed. But whatever. If we're lucky, we make it till 80 or maybe 85. Our children are borrowed. You know, the meal that I eat is borrowed. Everything is borrowed. And that is what we deal with. We deal with all the stuff that is borrowed. You know, and we get involved in that. And we somehow get into the drama of all of this, what is borrowed. And the way he expressed it is, he said, what we really got to get, we got to get to the unborrowed. We got to get to the unborrowed. That's the point, you know. And this is exactly the same thing as this. This is the same thing as mu. This is, of course, another word for mu. You know, it's a conceptual overlay of mu, you know, saying unborrowed. It's a description of mu. But it's another way, it adds another flavor to it. So our task here is not to bother with the borrowed. You know, the borrowed is what we deal with in our heads, but to somehow penetrate beyond that and go to the unborrowed. Try and find out what is the unborrowed. You know. So that is, anyway, I just thought I'll share that with you. Okay, so as Yamada Roshi says, Yamada Kohn Roshi says, you cannot really explain mu, and you shouldn't really try. It's about really, it just adds muddiness to it. Of course, we can talk about mu as in how do we get to a point and how do we practice to be able to see that. But to actually explain it intellectually is, that gets into metaphysics and all of that. It just confuses. It needs to be seen as, it's like, as I always say, trying to explain the taste of sugar or the taste of a cup of tea. Unless we taste it ourselves, it cannot be described. So what Mumon did, he wrote a commentary on Mu. And I'd like to go through that commentary now and just make some comments on that. He says, for the practice of Zen, you must pass the barrier set up by the ancient masters of Zen. Now, of course, the ancient masters of Zen is all the line of, if it goes back all the way to Shakyamuni Buddha. So please look at Zen not just as Zen as a Zen tradition, but all of Buddhism, and you can even go beyond that. All of the masters or all of the beings that have seen it, you know. So all of the beings that have seen it somehow have articulated it, and we now need to find out ourselves, for ourselves, what is it that they articulated? And each tradition has their own way of saying, this is how you do it, this is how you do it, this is how you do it, and Zen has its own way. Simple as that. And koans, of course, in many ways, are those barriers. So koans are these dialogues, encounter dialogues, or stories, if you like, that give us an opportunity to see through them. So in this case, what is mu? That's the question. So now that's, if we don't know that answer, we immediately make a barrier, and the barrier becomes mu. We make it. It's clearly visible to those that see it, but for those that don't, it's a barrier. So, for the practice of Zen, you must pass the barrier set up by the ancient masters of Zen. And when I say practice of, when he says the practice of Zen, that's what I talked about before. We have many practices, but those three practices all come back to the practice, you know, that, again, concentration practice, which we're doing on the cushion, the precept practice, and also the wisdom practice. To attain to marvelous enlightenment, you must completely extinguish all thoughts of the ordinary mind. Whoa. You must completely extinguish all thoughts of the ordinary mind. So what that means is, you can look at it differently. On the cushion, when we concentrate on mu, or on our object of concentration, if we do it correctly, all thoughts are extinguished. So it's completely melting into our object of meditation. That is what it is. Extinguish all thoughts. So if you like, we are at that moment, as we are doing that, we get a taste of an awareness level, or of an awareness that is beyond thoughts. That's what it is. So, and you all may have had which we call that samadhi, you know. And of course, some traditions go into different layers of that and how deep you go. And Zen normally doesn't really go into that to such a degree. But it is interesting. So there are different layers of, if you like, of concentration. And then different perceptions that arise out of that as well. So that is what is meant by that. To attain to marvelous enlightenment, you must completely extinguish all thoughts. So when we are sitting, we are suspending our thoughts. That's the job that we do. We suspend them. Okay. So extinguishing all thoughts does not mean that thoughts are our enemy. They just keep us so occupied that we are not aware of anything else except the thoughts. It's as simple as that. We are just so much engaged in our thinking that we don't see anything else. And that is why we can't see mu, because we're constantly thinking about something else, or describing it, or getting involved in it, mucking around in it, playing with it, whatever. That is what is meant by that extinguish all sort of the ordinary mind, the discursive mind. By the way, when we extinguish all thoughts, you know, what can happen is that when it actually happens, we experience a state of bliss. But when it doesn't happen, and in the process of doing it, you know, in the beginning stages of doing it, we might label that boredom. When you think about it, here we sit 7 days. I mean, how boring can it get? We just sit, we face the wall, and some people might call that, ooh, that's a very boring exercise. Okay. Now, I actually, in a way, there's nothing wrong with boredom. We need to, in a way, get utterly bored. And boredom, I looked at the etymology of that word, boredom. It comes from French, ennui. Don't know how that relates. But the German version of boredom is very interesting. Boredom in German means Langweile, which means long while. It's a long while. And when I looked at that and I thought, wow, that's actually, you know, a long while. To me, a long while, if we can manage to get into this long while, you know, that, I know I'm drawing conclusions here, but I get the sense of eternity. Beyond time and space, a long while. When we get into that mode of sitting, we are getting into that long while, into that boredom space. It's that sense of sitting. The only thing that actually discriminates, or the only thing that creeps up when I don't like it is time and space kicking in, saying I should be doing something else. What am I doing here? Something kicks in, which is our discriminating mind, and our discriminating mind lives in time and space, which, as we know, doesn't exist. Even science has proven that. So we live in this temporal sphere in our head, and yet it's not even there. And yet it's very hard to see beyond it. So getting into that zone of a long while, in many ways, this we need to get utterly bored to get into that. If we are not bored, you know, then we're discursively thinking. Of course, we want excitement. Oh, everyone wants excitement. And you know, the famous saying, what are you doing or what are you up to? It's we always stray away, want to somehow engage in excitement. We somehow feed that whole area of excitement. But in this case, in this session, please appreciate boredom. Please appreciate sitting for a long while and enter into that. So I just thought I'd mention that as well. So extinguish all thoughts of the ordinary mind is really entering that space of a long while. If you have not passed the barrier and have not extinguished all thoughts, you are a phantom haunting the weeds and the trees. And what that relates to, the hungry ghost, a phantom, that relates to samsara, that relates to our constant grasping for things, grasping for this and that, grasping for happiness, grasping for a new car, grasping for something else to eat, grasping for it to be warm when it's cold to be warm, that constant desire realm. Desire drives in a way our ordinary mind. Extinguish all thoughts. You're like a phantom haunting the weeds and the trees. Just like the hungry ghosts that in us, always in us. Now just tell me, what is the barrier set up by these patriarchs? What is the barrier? Merely this mu. Nothing else. Merely this mu. The one barrier of our sect. So it has come to be called the gateless barrier of the Zen sect. So gateless, again, gateless is because it is available to everyone. It can be seen by everyone. There is no one that can't see it. And it's gateless is because we create it in our mind, and we can't somehow manage to get rid of it. That's it. That's why it's called a gateless. Hakun Roshi, I think, the original, not quite the founder of Sanbo Zen, but the precursing, if you like, abbot or monk, he said, if you really concentrate on this, even the word gateless gate, you know, you can, if you really see what that means, you can actually get a Kensho experience. That's what, anyway, I was reading that the other day, and I thought I'd pass that on. Those who have passed the barrier are able not only to see Joshua face to face, but also to walk hand in hand with the whole descending line of patriarchs, and of course we must remember the matriarchs as well, and be eyebrow to eyebrow with them. Now here, as you know, the task is to let go, It's always the task in Zen is always to let go. But ultimately, what are we letting go of? I say let go of the story of who I think I am. You know, let go of that story. So it's a matter of when I let go of who I am, completely let go, then at the same time, I have let go of everyone else. And when that happens, we are able to see Joshua and all the patriarchs and all the matriarchs face to face. So it is that I don't need to let anything else go but me, myself, as in my little I. The story that I have, it's usually a story. That is what I need to let go. Everything is always looked at from that self-referencing perspective, and that is what I need to somehow let go of. And if you do, according to Mumon, you will not only see Joshua face to face, but also walk hand in hand with the whole descending line of our ancestors. You will see with the same eye that they see with, hear with the same ear that they hear with. Wouldn't it be a wonderful joy? Wouldn't it be a wonderful joy? I just want to mention something on joy. When we practice in the beginning, there's really two ways of practicing, or many ways of practicing, but two ways that I see it. There's the hard way and there's the soft way. Okay. So it's for newcomers, the soft way is very, very difficult. And we've got to find a balance. The hard way is getting into moo and really concentrating, sitting on the cushion and really making a really hard effort to penetrating moo. And there is actually no easy way around that. How are you going to really penetrate that unless you engage some discipline? First start, sit on the cushion, have a straight posture, and really have that discipline to say moo. So in Yasutani Roshi, in one of his books, actually, in one of his talks, I'm sure it came from a talk, he said, you must be so determined that you can almost imagine a samurai standing there with a sword, and at any moment, if you lose your concentration, he cuts your head off. So you've got to be so determined, you know, in order to get it. That is definitely the hard way. That is practicing the hard way. Okay. The soft way, to practice the soft way, is to just be. Relax. Just be. Let it unfold. That's the soft way. Now, the message I want to give here is that there is, especially for newcomers into this practice generally, there needs to be some discipline and there needs to be some hard practice. You know, otherwise, if we start off straight away with the soft way, it becomes too soft. And you can take a parallel here with Joriki. If we do not develop Joriki sufficiently, we get lost in the soft way. Our concentration is not strong enough and we just go away in our discursive thinking. That is the soft way. Of course, eventually we get to the point where our concentration is sufficiently capable of holding it, that we can very much more and more get into the easiness of it. But actually, to go straight away into the easiness is not easy. You know, you can actually compare it with the hindrances and the divine abodes, the Brahma Viharas. So in the beginning when we sit, we have lots of hindrances coming up. How do we get rid of the hindrances? By substituting them with moo. Or the hindrance comes up, I'm tired, moo. the hindrance comes up, you feel angry, or you, whatever hindrance comes up, we just let it come, let it be, but we keep on concentrating on mu. This is how we deal with the hindrances. And those that have done the introduction to Zen course, we are looking at that in great detail. Now, after a while, as we are climbing up that mountain, that mountain of effort that is required, that's effort required, that is still hard. There comes a point where we are at the top. We've reached a certain point where it becomes effortless. That is when the Brahma Viharas kick in. They're calling the Brahma Vihara in traditional Buddhist called the divine abodes. These are four elements of manifestations of an awakened being. They automatically kick in at that point. And these Brahma Viharas, I need to look them up exactly, are loving kindness, joy is one of them, compassion and equanimity. I can look at those, of course, straight away. I can look at compassion and loving kindness and joy and equanimity straight away, even without doing any practice. But it is very shallow, because you're then dealing with feelings. And feelings, this is not about feelings. We need to penetrate loving kindness, compassion, joy, equanimity beyond the levels of feelings. We need to get to a level that is the mu level, that is the unborrowed level, where that arises out of our practice. It arises as being rather than as a manufactured, well, loving kindness is this and this and this, and that is not loving kindness. That is not what it's about. And it certainly should not be compared with feelings either. You know. So it's very important to look at that. So if we look at your practice, the hard practice, the soft practice, it can be so hard that it becomes fixated, and it becomes too hard. That depends also on the personality. Some people, they really like that, but some people don't. And joy, same thing. It can become too much so that we forget the actual discipline, that we just get involved in some feeling of happiness, on some feeling of, I just feel good. That's not what the practice is about. Not about feeling good. It's going much deeper than that. So just be aware of that. And wouldn't it be a wonderful joy, he says, that comes out automatically when we get mu, when we see mu. Joy arises. Loving kindness arises. Equanimity arises. Compassion arises as well. Isn't there anyone who wants to pass this barrier? Of course not. Everyone wants to pass this barrier. But at the same time, not many people have the opportunity, or even, if you like, the inclination to even go along that path. So if you want to do it, then concentrate your whole self into this mu, making your whole body with its 360 bones and joints and 84,000 pores into a solid lump of doubt. So the doubt here, very simply, is our discursive thinking. Why? What is it that? Why can't I see it? It's the thoughts that come in that disrupt us from seeing it. So, at the same time, that frustration that builds up drives the process. It's like we need to have a goal, even if that goal is to have no goal. You need to start. You need to have a goal in order to go to the goalless. You know, we need to have a goal of sitting and a goal of doing it, even though we let go of it all. We need to let go of it all, melt into it. So it's a little bit like that. That doubt, day and night without ceasing, keep digging into it. So here at Sesshin, we have an opportunity to practice day and night for 7 days or 6 days. Day and night, you know, without ceasing, keep digging into it. Of course, we will get distracted. As soon as we get off the cushion, we feel like it is relaxing. We can now walk, or we can go to our room, or we can have a meal, or we have some chanting. But please keep in mind that this opportunity. You've made it here. You've taken away commitments from family, from work, to be here. Make it your determination to concentrate on Mu 24/7. And concentration on Mu is concentration on the cushion. It's Mu. Off the cushion is whatever you're doing. If it's eating, you just eat. So again, we have started this Orioki style meal. There's a story that we bring to it. That's the me, the I. I don't like this. What's this food? Wouldn't it be better? Wouldn't that be healthier than that? And why did they do this? And why do we do? That's the story that we bring to it. Let it go. And what do you substitute it with? Now. What is now? Now. What is now? Eating is now. Drinking is now. Washing the bowls is now. All of that is now. To what degree can you see now without adding anything to it? That is the practice. To what degree can you walk without walking, without you having a story about walking? To what degree can you do any activity, whether it's in your daily life or here at Sesshin, without constantly feeding it with your emotions, with your judgments? That's the task that we have. That's the opportunity that we have here for 7 days to practice that. Day and night without ceasing. Keep digging into it. In other words, don't let go of your concentration of being present. But don't take it as nothingness. In other words, Mu means no. Don't make something out of it. No matter what arises, no matter what you get, throw it away. And if you get nothing, as Joshua said, throw that away too. You know, throw it away. Always throw it away. In other words, let go. Let go. Don't take it as nothingness or being or non-being. It must be like a red hot iron ball which you have gulped down and which you try to vomit but cannot. So that is really an image of there's no way out. It's a total melting into Mu. Total melting into it. Where are we? You must extinguish all delusive thoughts and beliefs which you have cherished up to the present. So it's talking about delusive thoughts. So in other words, all thoughts that you have cherished, meaning right now, all thoughts are gone. Of course, if you have a thought about what you need to do next week and a thought about maybe if you're writing an assignment as a student or you need to do something for work, you need to work with these sorts of things. So that doesn't mean we get rid of all thoughts. But if you are engaged in right now, at that moment, let go of all of that. Just let go of all of that right now. After a certain period of such efforts, Mu will come to fruition. Mu itself will come to fruition. And inside and out will become one naturally. So here the image is inside and out. There is no inside and out. Inside and out will become one. So all opposites coalesce. Inside and out will become one naturally. Here and there, 6 and 7, inside and out, all dualities will melt into one. You will then be like a dumb man, let's not forget the women, who has had a dream. You will know yourself for yourself only. So this refers to our true self. You will know yourself, as in self, lowercase s, and self, capital cases. Please don't make a thing out of self or true self. And these are just words. We need words to communicate. So don't make anything out of that. But this is the true self is really another word for Mu. Another word for who am I beyond my story. So you will know yourself, who you are beyond your story, if you like, for yourself only. Then all of a sudden, Mu will break open. It will astonish the heavens and shake the earth. It will be just as if you had snatched the great sword of General Khan. No one ever snatched General Khan's sword, but all of a sudden you will be able to do that. If you meet a Buddha, you will kill him. Any concept that you have, you get rid of. Buddha is not outside. He is not inside. So any concept of Buddha, bang, get rid of it. Any concept of holy, bang, get rid of it. Any concept of yourself, any concept of Zen, any concept of the teachings, you continuously slash, go about and slash it. Though you may stand on the brink of life and death, you will enjoy great freedom. So life and death here can mean, in many ways, we need to die. We need to die on the, we say dying on the cushion. What that means is we need to let go of who we think we are. And that is death. That is referred to as death here. We need to let go of who we are so you can start your funeral before your actual physical body goes away. Let go of that. You know. And though you may stand on the brink of life and death, and by the way, it's not easy to let go. Some people really experience resistance. There's always that, you know, we have this, especially when you go into deeper levels of concentration, there is resistance there. Resistance and fear quite often. And don't be afraid. You know, jump into it. Jump off the cliff. That's what they're saying. That's what Mumon is giving. Just jump off and see what happens. You know, and when that happens, you will enjoy great freedom. You know, or as the Christians would say, you're reborn. You're born again. You know, that's what the Christians would say. In the six realms and the four modes of birth. Again, that's typical in those days. In the six realms and the four modes of birth. That is, again, going into Buddhist mythology. You will live in the samadhi of innocent place. The samadhi, the image here of samadhi is concentration of innocent play. There is nothing, there is nowhere to go, nowhere to call home. Innocent place, as in there's nowhere to anchor. It's just a very innocent place. Innocent play, I should say. So play here has this joyful connotation again. So when you get to that point, it is very joyous. And it is you and it is a play. There's nothing that needs to be done. It plays itself. Or as James says quite often, it's a dance. You know, you just all of a sudden it's a dance, you know. Now how should you concentrate on Mu? How should you concentrate on Mu? Exhaust every ounce of energy you have in doing it. And if you do not give up on the way, you will be enlightened the way a candle in front of the altar is lighted by one touch of fire. All of a sudden, bang, it happens like that. Okay, now that's the commentary that Mumon gave on this koan, quite a long commentary, beautiful commentary. And then he wrote a verse, as is custom. Dog, Buddha nature. Now listen, please listen to this. Dog, Buddha nature. The perfect manifestation, the absolute command. It's right there. A little has or has not. In other words, any story, I can hear the thinking going on. Any story about it is a little has or has not. A little has or has not. Yeah. Body is lost, life is lost. So that's talking about that life after Kensho, that body. In other words, we keep on being the ghosts that haunt the weeds. A little has or has not. A little story about it. Dog. Buddha nature. A little has or has not. Body is lost, life is lost.